All your favorite CBC podcasts are now available on YouTube. The best in award-winning true crime investigations, hilarious comedies, vibrant pop culture conversations, and even more audio series are all available on CBC Podcast's YouTube channel. You'll also find exclusive video first episodes, YouTube shorts, and behind-the-scenes content from our hosts and producers that you can't find anywhere else. So if YouTube is your go-to source for podcasts, just search CBC Podcasts and hit subscribe, and you'll never miss the latest update.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. It's cool to be here doing the show right now because I'm sure you can't really hear the difference, but I'm actually in a studio in Los Angeles right now. We came down to do a really special interview. I'm excited for you to hear all about. So stay tuned for that. If you follow concerts or popular music at all, something that's probably come across your Facebook or Instagram feed is this show. It's like you two performing at the Sphere in Las Vegas. And it's not necessarily because of the music. It's less of a concert and more of like a psychedelic trip. You two are on stage, and then behind them, there's this constantly moving immersive art beamed on a 76 meter tall, 15,000 square meter screen that completely surrounds you and the band. So the reason I'm telling you about all this is because one of the people responsible for those visuals is the British artist Ez Devlin. And changing the way concerts are seen, changing the way you experience a show, making them bigger and grander, is kind of her thing. Ez has designed shows for Adele, Lady Gaga, The Rolling Stones, The Weeknd. She was the creator behind Beyoncé's Formation and Renaissance tours. She did the closing ceremony for the London Olympics. She's done theater, opera, I mean the Canadian Opera Company's recent performances of Don Giovanni, she did those. The halftime show from the 2022 Super Bowl, you know, the one that was the big celebration of hip-hop with Dr. Dre, she did that. But here's the thing. No matter how big the star, no matter how huge the show, it always starts the same way. A blank table, a blank piece of paper, and she and the artist just have a conversation, and she sketches. Ez has just released a monograph of her work. It's called An Atlas of Ez Devlin. There's an exhibition of the same name at New York's Cooper Hewitt Museum right now. And I got to talk to Ez from her home in London about her story, why she kind of wants you to be able to hear a song through your skin, what that means, and what it was about the concert experience that she wanted to change. Here's my conversation with the artist and set designer, Ez Devlin. This is something else. This tome here I'm holding right now. Congratulations on it.
Well, thank you so much. And it is quite a relief. It took me 7 years to make the book. And now I feel very relieved that it is all gathered together, because what I make is sometimes quite ephemeral. And I even forget that I made it. So sometimes when people ask me, what do you do? I take a deep breath, because there's quite a lot of different things that I do. But now I can just give them the book and say, here's what I do. Please read it. Please have a look. And then we can talk afterwards. And it's a great relief. It's a relief.
I want to talk about the initial tiny object that sort of starts your work. One of the things that you learn about you really quickly when you get interested in your work is the beginning of the process. No matter who the artist is, no matter how many kajillions of records they've sold, it starts the same way. A blank table, a blank piece of paper, and a conversation with the artist. What are you listening for in those conversations? And can you give me an example of something that you might be sketching?
Really, I'm looking for common lines of inquiry. And I believe that everyone we meet, whether we're having a conversation with a person at a bus stop or whether we're talking with a collaborator about work we might make together, we are looking, because we're humans and that's what we do. We're looking for crossroads, meeting points, because we've come on a journey ourselves and we've made allegiances, made fascinations. There are things we care about. And when we meet someone, we're looking for a point of intersection, a convergence of lines of inquiry, so that we can go forward together with a shared passion to communicate something vital that someone else might also intersect with. So, yeah, a common thread is what I'm looking for in the first instance.
So if someone says something that feels you have some commonality with, some sort of like iota of shared humanity through something you've said, then what? Then you start sketching that thing?
Yeah. And then we have to do that again and again and again with every breath. And what I have learned over the years is that there's a flow state that you can arrive in. And when you're in that state of flow, then everybody's ideas can join it. And you stop. I learned quite quickly in my practice to not block other people's ideas, to learn that actually other people's ideas are more interesting than my own, and that I will expand by absorbing someone else's idea. And the real test is when someone proposes something in a collaboration that you absolutely, every atom of your body reviles against. You know, they say, well, why don't we do it in bubblegum pink? And it was the opposite of what you had in mind. It was the absolute opposite of anything you would dream of doing. But instead of saying, oh, we're not doing that, you say, okay. And you try to imagine it. And then normally what will happen is if you can go through the veil of the pink bubblegum suggestion, you will come out with a new thing that you would never have thought of in your own. Why? Because your own little batch of poems, your own little backpack of experience does not converge with that other person. So you are properly meeting not just another human being, but everything that led up to them being there in that room with you. And that's the way we evolve, I think, and grow and see through others' perspectives.
It's such a remarkable way to gain compassion or empathy for somebody. And in this book, there are some of my favorite moments in this whole book are, you know, when we get towards the big concert spectacles that you're known for, and your sketchings, your drawings from those initial meetings, I'm assuming, are included in there. So you have, you know, what would become a really big weekend show in Las Vegas, and then you see the initial drawing. When you were looking back at those to make this book happen or to gather everything for the book to be made, can you give me an example of something that, I guess when you saw the sketch, you said, oh yeah, there it was. There's the essence of what we ended up doing right there.
Yeah, actually, the example that moved me the most, I guess, when I unlocked the door to a vast room full of all my stuff that literally I hadn't stepped in for 30 years at all. So when I went in there and had a look at these, and I started cracking open these boxes, there was one set of sketches that I found. And I think I did them when I was about 19 years old. And they are a set of drawings of a person, a small female figure in a box. And the figure is in the box and they're somewhat too big for it. And then they're in another box and they're tiny and they're way too small for it. And then they're on top of it. And then they're throwing it up like a jigsaw puzzle, and then they're wrestling with it like a climbing frame. And it shocked me because it did make me realize that I've been grappling with these questions of an organic form of a human and a geometric form of a frame or a box or a container or a piece of geometry really since I was that age in lots of different ways. With lots of different partners, you know.
Why do you think, I noticed that when I was going through the book, and God knows I'm no artist and I'm no art critic, but I did see, even from your earliest stage work, boxes come up a lot. And even when I'm looking at you in the way that you've framed yourself in the Zoom right now, you're surrounded by sort of like a square box figure. Can you hazard a guess as to maybe something from your childhood or something from your life that made you so interested in boxes as part of your aesthetic?
I'm really interested in systems and why things are the way they are. Understanding, analyzing systems. And my downfall is I'm interested in all sorts of systems. You know, I could quite happily just scrutinize your Zoom window here and start to look at why your lights are like that, why the curtain's like that, why is the wall like that, and try and get under the bonnet.
Please do, and you can bill me later. That's fine.
Why those choices were made. So, I'm really interested in social systems. I'm interested in why humans arrange themselves in hierarchies, in orders. When is it helpful? When could we outgrow? I'm interested in when is the box or the frame the right size for the human, and when has the human actually outgrown it or grown beyond it, or how do two people fit? How do 20 people fit? And I guess I studied literature when I was younger, and my access point, I guess, into most of what I read was what's the system, what's going on here, and do I agree with it, and how might I change it? And I guess the further I've gone on in my practice, the more I've tried to find ways that perhaps when we do a rehearsal of a system in a play or in an opera or at a concert or at an art piece, perhaps we leave something of that questioning of a system in the mind of the audience. And especially now, when the systems that we are, I guess, formed and shaped by seem to be creaking and cracking under the strain of evolutions of technology and humanity in general, I think it could be probably agreed some of the systems that we live by could do with some evolution. So it feels anyway like a kind of, all of the work I've made for 30 years feels like a bit of a rehearsal towards social change, I guess, in a way.
Well, that would make sense because in your work, it's not just the boxes, but the breaking out of them that comes up. I want to stay with your early days here just for a second. The book is sent around objects that help tell your story of your life and art. Certainly a box would be one of them, but one of them is your family's turntable, this sort of old red and white portable turntable. So I wanted to talk to you about some of the music that was formative to you as an artist. Just take a listen. As Devlin, I can see you having a bit of an emotional reaction to that. Can you tell me what we're listening to and how you're feeling now that you're hearing it?
I mean, I'm not alone here, am I? But Kate Bush, The Kick Inside. I defy anyone not to have a reaction to that piece.
Why is that so important to your story?
I think something happens when you're 13 and it happens in your room. And you've got a bedroom and it becomes your, if you're lucky, I was fortunate enough to have that. But even when I was sharing a room, you extend, you begin to understand that your personhood, your personality can be worn like a piece of clothing on the walls of your room. And the room can be an extension of yourself. And I guess what I thought was, could I make my room make people feel like this music made me feel when I was 13. And anyone who knows this album, The Kick Inside by Kate Bush, will know that the album cover was somewhat, let's say, a kitsch version of a Chinese story or Japanese story, let's say. And The Kick Inside was made out of kind of katakana, a version of Japanese symbols to say Kate Bush, Kick Inside. So I thought, well, I would paint a Japanese mural on my wall. So I got a book of Japanese art and I painstakingly painted every inch of the walls of this rather, it was an attic room, so it was quite irregular shaped, but I just painted straight over every bit of skirting board or plug in the wall. I just painted over. So like, there was Japanese characters with big plugs coming out of their heads because I wasn't to be deterred. It was my belief that if anyone might, you know, I was trying to identify myself with boys, with girls, with friends, that if they stepped into this room, they would feel like that music. And that's how I wanted them to feel in my space.
Why was that what was interesting to you? Because one of the things that I think you really have a knack for, if I could be use that word with you, is your ability to convey sort of the feeling you get when you listen to an Adele song or you listen to a U2 record or a weekend show, or we're going to talk about the Super Bowl in just a second, through the concert experience. Like you feel like you're listening to the music, you feel like you're embodying the spirit of the music while at the show or even looking at the show. But you started as a musician. Like you were, I saw that Netflix documentary of you and you got good vibrato there on the violin. You know, you're still playing pretty well. Why were you interested in transmitting how music feels rather than transmitting your own music?
I have a feeling that this moment that we're living through where we say a musician does music and an artist does art and an interior designer does interior design is an aberration from how we were evolved as a species to exist. I think we're synesthetic, all of us. I think we smell music. I think we hear color. And I think the only reason we don't talk about it too much is there was a moment or a period of moments where we started to find it efficient to separate so that we could excel. So if I hadn't sat in a room for years practicing my scales, I wouldn't have been able to play the violin. So I had to do that focus, separation. And of course, all the excellent humans who focus on one thing, we wouldn't be without them. But I do think at this point, we realize that what we've lost a bit in the separation in order to excel is the recognition of ourselves as synesthetic beings, as in beings who experience through every pore of our skin. So I think we experience poetry through our feet. I think if you walk while you are reading a poem, you will experience it differently. And I think you can experience music through the color of the walls of the room and through the smells of, you know, what you're smelling while you're hearing it. I think we're intelligent at merging all the different senses at once.
But it wasn't hard to put down the violin and professionally?
Oh, I never got that far. You know, I was never very good at all. What I loved about the violin and the clarinet and the piano, and I got them all up to a level, was I loved being part of a sound that was way bigger than anything I could do on my own. And I was always at the back of the second violin, scratching away, frankly. But I was amazed that I could be part of this big sound that we were making together. So it was a real lesson to me in sublimation of the self to a bigger thing. And in collaboration. And by the way, I was really interested in drawing my violin as well as playing it. I was fascinated by why it looked like that. And I would ask the teacher, does it have to look this beautiful to sound this beautiful?
Mm.
Or could it be ugly and sound beautiful? You know, I was interested in that.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. I mean, doesn't that story just tell you everything? You're listening to my conversation with Ez Devlin, the artist and set designer. And the reason that story kind of tells you everything is because she's behind some of the biggest concert tours of the 21st century. I mean, she's made the shows you've seen on Instagram and Facebook and maybe even in real life look the way they look. She designed Beyoncé's Formation and Renaissance shows. She did Adele and The Weeknd's World Stadium tours, as she's done the Super Bowl. I was interested to know when Ez started out, when she was watching concerts, what didn't work for her? What did she want to see differently? So I asked her.
So when you started designing, design, I guess, for concerts, for lack of a better word, what did you want to change about the way that concerts looked?
Well, my experience was very specific in that when I was a teenager, about 16 years old, I started to go out with a guy who at the time was a sound engineer, and he became a record producer. And we were together for a long time, 13 years, and we went to a lot of concerts. Bands he was working with, and I spent a lot of time in the recording studio as well. So I started to understand what happens in a recording studio, the craft of the engineer. And then I would go to the concert. And having had this exquisite, layered, you know, perfectly calibrated experience in the studio, visually the concerts that I saw, and this isn't really so much a comment on the concerts I could have seen. There were amazing Pink Floyd things I didn't go to.
Yeah.
But the ones I went to were generally, I guess we were seeing small bands in small places. It would be what they call a rag, which is basically a backdrop that they just got out of a hamper because they had to get it out of a truck. And it was a rag. And they might have a gag. The gag would rhyme with the rag. And the gag might be, I don't know what the gag, yeah, gags and rags. And and it was normally, my boyfriend at the time was into rock, so it was normally rock music. So it would be the rock band shape. So it would be three people standing and then one sitting, but they didn't want the sitting drummer to have his head lower than the three standing ones. So they would put him on a little thing.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was a mess.
When you say I thought that was a mess, help me understand that better.
Well, I, you know, obviously I'm a control freak. Look at the boxes. I just wanted to tidy the thing up. I was like, well, there's all this mess on the floor. Like, you know, it wasn't confidently like a mess. It wasn't like a riot of mess. It was just kind of ill-considered, I thought, which I didn't find interesting.
1, 2, X, U!
It was the band Wire, right? The early band where you sort of take the band out of that sort of pentagram formation where they're across with the drummer on the riser above you, and you have the band in these boxes across the stage. I love the story you tell that you didn't think about how they were going to get out of the boxes in order to take a bow.
I have never seen Spinal Tap. People keep telling me that I don't need to because I live it. But what happened there was this wonderful band. They actually asked me to do a show, and it was in the very early days of email, and for some reason I didn't get it. So they asked Dinos and Jake Chapman, who were wonderful young British artists, quite celebrated in the day, to do the show. So they came up with an amazing first half of the show, which was, at the time, there were aerobics lessons on breakfast TV, and they would wear like green Lycra body suits. So Dinos and Jake Chapman, these young conceptual artists, surrounded the whole of this post-punk band with, I think, 100 people doing aerobics. And that was their statement. And it was pretty cool. And then I got an email from this guy saying, oh, are you sure you don't want to do, because we've still got the second half of the show. And I was in Sweden in an internet cafe. It was like before the time where you had internet on your laptop or anything. And I said, oh, I never heard about this. What's this? He said, oh, we thought you couldn't do it. So we still got the second half. Do you want to do it? I said, cool, I'm in Sweden. He said, well, I'm in Sweden. And it turned out Wire were playing in the pub next door to the internet cafe where I was.
No, in Sweden, really?
In Sweden. So I said, well, I'll just come over. So I went and had a look, and it was just like, wah, wah. Full on, you know, pretty, chaotic, extraordinary, intelligent, post-punk, noise, songs, music, beautiful.
And progressives, rich deciduous, copies with beats, aphorism.
And I said, well, this, I have to do this, but can I do a portrait of you? Can I make a composite portrait of you as a band? Can I have your nose, your eyes, your mouth, your ear, and can I just have a little camera that just films the drummer's nose, the guitarist? You know, I wanted to piece them together as a jigsaw band. And then I said, can I have you all wearing ECG heart rate reading machines so that we have a composite heart rate throughout? And of course, I really wanted to have EEG machine that read the sort of MRI scan is what I wanted, actually, on the back.
Big brainwaves.
Yeah, but that was beyond our £2,000 budget. So I actually faked that, and I got some brainwaves that someone had recorded earlier of a nurse in a hospital. So I put them on the back. And then actually during the drummer's heart rate reading thing obviously fell off while he was drumming. So he flatlined.
they thought he might have passed away during the gig.
No one noticed because they thought it was art, so nobody minded. And then we had these little cameras on their faces, and it was a joy. It was one night only, but yeah, that's how it all began.
That's Ez Devlin, the award-winning artist. Coming up, Ez will tell you what went into one of her most famous shows. It was the 2022 Super Bowl halftime show. That was the one with Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg and Kendrick Lamar and Mary J. Blige and Eminem. And she tells an amazing story about when she signed on to do that. She was given a tour of Compton, and I asked her, you know, what did she take from that? Like, what did she take from that tour that actually made it onto the stage? And she had some really amazing stories about that. So more with the great Ez Devlin coming up. Plus, you're going to hear from the Canadian dancer, DJ Caraba, who made it to a pretty high level. She was dancing for the likes of like Selena Gomez and Drake when all of a sudden she stopped and started making music of her own. Now she's nominated for a Juno. She'll be here to tell you that story. That's after this on Q.
It's still Dre Day, AK. Though I've grown a lot, can't keep it home a lot. Cause when I frequent the spots that I'm known to rock, you hear the bass from the truck when I'm on the block. Ladies, they pay homage, but haters say Dre fell off. How? My last album was The Chronic. They wanna know if he still got it. They say rap's changed. They wanna know how I feel about it.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. You're in the middle of my conversation with Ez Devlin, the artist and set designer. She has a new book about her work. It's called An Atlas of Ez Devlin. Ez does theater, opera, you know, the Olympic ceremonies, her own art. But she's best known for doing shows for the likes of Adele and Miley Cyrus, The Weeknd, U2, not to mention she designed Beyoncé's Formation and Renaissance tours. I mean, some of the biggest concerts in history. Ez was also responsible for a really memorable performance from a couple of years ago, the 2022 Super Bowl halftime show, which featured, you know, Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg and Kendrick Lamar and Mary J. Blige. It's one that really resonated with a lot of millennials and a lot of people who grew up loving hip hop, because it was the first time that hip hop was really centered as part of the halftime show. Ez talks about that show in her new book, and I wanted to find out more about what went into it. So here's the rest of our conversation.
The National Football League welcomes you to the Pepsi Super Bowl 56 halftime show.
It's the one and only Eagle Double G.
Snoop Dogg!
You know what happened with the D-R-E.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Y'all know what this is. But can y'all make some noise for my man Snoop Dogg?
As I remember watching that, I mean, I was born in 87, so I mean, this was a very important generational halftime show. It felt like everybody I knew was watching it. You had Snoop Dogg, and you had, you know, 50 Cent and Mary J. Blige, but you also had people like Eminem, and you had, you know, Kendrick Lamar in there as well. You talk about how it was important to be taken on a tour of Compton, where most of this music originated from in Los Angeles, before you started working on this project. Where did you go? What did you notice? And how did it help?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, firstly, what a privilege and an honor to be invited to be part of telling that story. I mean, my own story is very far from it. I'm from the other side of the planet, from a very different set of coordinates on the planet. And so I felt really honored and privileged to be invited. And I thought the first thing I would do, of course, as I do in every project, is research. Well, I need to learn. I need to, you know, make myself sort of worthy of taking this on. So it was really through Dre himself and Kendrick and Dave Free, who is Kendrick's creative director. And Dave introduced me to his dear school friend and Kendrick's friend, who still lives in Compton, Tramell. And Tramell took me around Compton. And I wanted to go to the places on the planet that had really been the sites of instigation of some of the lyrics. And of course, there is this, again, talking about converging lines of inquiry, there are places where Kendrick stood many years later, where Dre had stood, and both had formative experiences on those spots, on the same spot on the planet. And it's really important to me to tell people that music doesn't come from the air. Music comes from a place on the planet and comes from lived experience. You know, it doesn't come from algorithms or from technology. That those are great tools to develop it, but it comes from it's rooted on this great earth. So I wanted to go to those places. We went to Tam Burger. I tried to order a veggie burger, which didn't go down very well. what are you talking about? Tramell quickly moved me on.
what of that trip? Like, can you give me an example of something you saw that day that made it into the show?
Oh, everything. I mean, we had a duplicate of Tam Burger. There was the exterior of a club. We didn't go in, and it had shut down. But it was the reference for Eve After Dark, which was a club that was very specifically mentioned lyrically. There was also the Martin Luther King Memorial, which was the first registered architect of color had designed that. And it was a really important moment in that place, a real moment of hope. And yet next to it, of course, is the jail, both of which, the jail, which Eminem sprung out of, and the monument are both there in that sequence. The Compton Cowboys, who are learning to ride horses and continuing the tradition of African-American cowboy culture in Compton, that blew me away. And the kind of rural aspect to it, you know, there's an aspect of allotments, we would call them here, places where people are farming. Understanding the redlining culture, understanding the way that segregation persisted through behavior, if not through, you know, explicitly through politics. It was shocking to me to learn about that. So yeah, you know, understanding the way that society is formed by choices that are made by policymakers, property developers, architects, and, you know, songs come out of those policies and some pain that was caused by those choices. So it made a very deep impression on me that I wanted to communicate through the piece. Still taking my time to perfect the beat, and I still got love for the streets. It's the DRE.
Okay, so I want to stay on that because you talked to me a little bit about going to these shows, these, you know, these punk shows or these rock shows when you were growing up. And those would have been things that you would have had to go to experience. You would have had to go to these shows in order to experience that. I feel like I have some knowledge of the Sphere U2 show, which I say you had a hand in, because of TikTok, because of Instagram Reels. How does that change how you do your work, or does it? Knowing that people are going to be seeing shows like big spectacle shows like this through iPhones, through TikTok, through Instagram.
I think my practice very much found an audience through the convergence of the evolution of my practice with the evolution of technology that communicated what I did. When we were beginning and we were making concerts at the beginning, it was before the camera phone. It was before certainly the prevalence, the ubiquity of a camera phone. And if we wanted to show the artist who was singing how their show looked, we would take photographs on a SLR, beautiful big Canon camera or whatever, and we would go up to them and show them and say, hey, this is how it looks, because they didn't know how their show looked. And then, of course, the minute the phone started to turn up, really the ubiquity began, I would say, in 2007 with the advent of the iPhone. Suddenly, each artist is seeing this multi-camera, crowdsourced, three-dimensional film of their performance. And, you know, with the advent of social media, of course, they're seeing it everywhere. And they're piecing it together. And for sure, there's a consideration of that now. There's no doubt. There's a consideration. But I must say, the Florence and the Machine concert that I went to, it must have been 4 or 5 years ago, it was before the pandemic. And the way that she gathered an arena, because she had very politely said, let's not do our phones tonight. And she had the kind of audience that respected her and just said, okay, let's not. And no one had a phone. No one had one. No one. And she treated the audience like a congregation, and she got them all singing, she got them all weeping, hugging their neighbours. It was a ritual. And I must say, you do notice a little bit at the Sphere, beautiful and spectacular it is, that certainly at the beginning, people were so keen to film every moment that it was quite hard for them to dance. Because they would have messed up their shot. You know, if you're being a cameraman, it's a little bit hard to dance, or a camera woman. So, yeah.
Well, can you dance? Can you, not in general, but can you dance and enjoy a show that you've designed when you go to it? Or are you just critiquing yourself the whole time?
Oh, no, I really do dance. And I'm just, you know, because we're making the show, and we're having tons of conversations about it. We're drawing it. We're, you know, our job is to envisage things that don't yet exist. So we're constantly trying to conjure in our imaginations things that hopefully haven't yet existed at all, or haven't existed in this way. And so the release, even me now, you're just turning on a little bit of music, the release of putting music on and just not putting it through the front part of the brain, but just letting the old limbic system, the ancient part of the brain, do the processing and let the body respond to it. I do that even when we're in technical rehearsals, even when we're making a show. I really enjoy it. I really love that aspect of making. I do a lot of different things. I still make theatre and opera. I make a lot of art at the moment, actually, art installations. But I would really miss the music if I didn't have that loud. I mean, we just made a Bad Bunny tour, and I must say, that goes off. Oh my God, that music, that audience, they go off. We opened it in Salt Lake City, and it was everyone jumping, screaming. Yeah, the energy was sublime, sublime.
Well, I think that really comes across in this book, where it's as much about your own story as an artist as it is about the appreciation of taking in art and your addition to that. You how much you want to emphasize the beautiful things that art gives us through your own work. And I really enjoyed reading it, and I really enjoyed talking to you today. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Ez Devlin is a set designer and artist. Her new book about her work, An Atlas of Ez Devlin, is out now. If you happen to find yourself in New York, you can see an exhibition of the same name at the Cooper Hewitt Museum until August. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. So, not to give away any trade secrets here, but on this show, you usually end up hearing me, talk to people about how they made their dreams come true. I don't know, maybe that sounds a bit cheesy, but come on, we're a show about artists. It's kind of the business model. What you don't often hear, however, is a conversation with someone who walked away from their lifelong dream at the height of their success to start something new from scratch. That's why I was excited to speak with DJ Caraba. She's a DJ and producer based in Montreal. She's nominated for her first Juno for the song Mad Mess. But check this out. Before all that, DJ Caraba was a backup dancer on tour. She was dancing behind the likes of like Drake and Selena Gomez and Camila Cabello. So we got on the line and we talked about what makes someone give up everything they worked for to chase a new dream, what her parents thought about that decision, and actually how being a dancer helps you make better dance music. I started by asking her what that world of backup dancing, very mysterious world, is actually like.
It's very intense. It's interesting that you say that, because when you're not in it, I feel like most of it, like general people that don't know the dancing world, they don't really know about it. But when you're in it, it's very intense. I mean, it's auditions after auditions. It's, you can be let go at any time. You can be replaced at any time. It's like we give our life to this form of art that I feel very often is not enough celebrated for all the work that we put in. It's a very tough world, but I mean, I'm passionate about it, and I'm still am, and I love dancing, so it's always going to be a part of me for sure.
So you were dancing with these big stars, and then you decide I need to be a DJ. Is that right?
Yeah, I just think that after a while, it was becoming repetitive for me, if I can put it that way.
What was?
I think my biggest dream as a dancer was always to do tours. I always wanted to do that. And after I would say in 2018, I had done maybe four at that time. And so there wasn't any other steps for me in my career. I didn't want to be a choreographer or the other steps that you would do when you're done being a dancer. Usually you open your dance school, or I don't know, you become a choreographer, all these things. And I just didn't have it in me. And I'm someone who loves a challenge. And I was just like, I think that it's time for me to move on to something else. And I also felt like I had a lot to offer, as an artist. And I just felt like I was kind of stuck into this position of being a backup dancer. and I wanted to explore more, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I understand. I would, no shame in that. Like, I have been, I've been, as they say, 30 feet from stardom. Like, I'm, you know, I'm in the back row, and I want to know what it's like to be at the front of that stage.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly that.
But how you did it is really interesting, because I tell you what I find inspiring about the story, if I get it right, is that when you become exceptional and you do exceptionally well at something, and you know it very well, you know dancing really, really well. And that's because probably when you were young, you got all of the mistakes out of the way and all the embarrassment. And there's no embarrassment when we're kids. We can learn how to do things. To learn music and to learn DJing, do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
To go into a room and say, I don't know something at that stage of your career, that's not easy.
It's not. It really isn't. And I'm still learning. I mean, I'm always going to be a learner. I think that's the beauty of art. I don't think you get to a point where I guess with dance, I get to a point where I was excelling in it and I was a professional dancer and I was working, but I think you can always work on your craft. And that's how I see it also with music. I mean, I'm 4 years into making music and a bit more into DJing, but you're right about the mistakes. And I think as an adult, for me, sometimes it's hard because, again, I'm competitive. I do sometimes think like, oh, like, am I supposed to be here? Like, I have this feeling sometimes of the imposter syndrome. Like, I'm just a human, you know, but at the same time, I'm passionate and I love what I do and I love art. And I think that really is what puts me through that journey. And yeah.
Who did you talk to? Did you talk to the members of the bands that you were touring with or the artists that you were touring with to say like, hey, I think I want to do this. I want to be a musician.
Yeah, I did. I talked to actually one of the vocalists on Selena's tour. Her name is Nayana. And then we went for a coffee because sadly the tour was canceled because of Selena was going through some medical problems. And so we sat down and I told her, like, I don't have a plan B, but I don't want to do the usual choreography and all that. And she was like, you've been talking about how much you love music and you're that girl that played the playlist on the tour bus and you know, you love music and DJing. So why not just take classes? Like, why not? And I was just like, you know what? Like, okay, why not? So that's how it started. And then I still am in contact with some of the people that from the tour that are in the music industry and all that. And then I'll go back to them when I have questions or stuff like that. Yeah.
Are you better at knowing what music will make people dance because you're a dancer yourself?
Yeah, for sure. I'm confident in that. Yes.
Tell me. I've never seen anyone answer a question so quickly in my life. The half the sentence wasn't even out of my mouth and you were like, uh-huh, yeah, I am.
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
I just know, you know, I'll listen to a track and then if I don't dance, then people won't dance to it. It's natural in me. And then I think that's so fascinating for me and so exciting when I select my music for a set. It's like, I go through it and I'm like, this doesn't feel right. This feels like I would dance a little bit. Oh, this feels like I would really dance to it. So that's the exciting part about it, to be honest. It's like, I get to like feel already what people are gonna feel, but maybe they might feel different. But I feel like because I have the dancing thing in me, then I know how people are gonna react to it.
Does that mean when you're doing shows, when you're looking out into the crowd, you're thinking different things than the average DJ is?
I used to in the beginning, and now I don't really think about it anymore. I kind of just...
What do you mean?
I used to like look around and try to play to the crowd and try to be like, oh, are they liking this? Like, I was very like fixating on this. And then after a while, I was like, it's too much. I kind of want to be in my own bubble. Well, with the crowd always, but like just playing music and feel the vibe and kind of go with it and have them discover music and not always play what they want to hear, but like trying to push different sound. Like, it has become my thing for me that I want to introduce new sound to the crowd more than just being like, oh, I know they're going to like this or they already know this, so I'm going to play this song, you know?
It's a really interesting, yeah, it does. And it's a really interesting world you found yourself in of like dance and rhythm and DJing. So what I know of you is you grew up in Grenoble, right, in France until you moved to Montreal when you were like 6 or 7 or something
like
that?
Yeah, 7, yeah.
And was there music and art in your house? Was this an easy transition for you?
My parents were a huge fan of music. They met at a club, so I'm guessing that was just natural for us in the family. But yeah, my dad loved music. I mean, he's still alive, so he loves music. My mom too. It was like very African. Like my dad is Congolese, so we had a lot of that. And then my mom was a huge fan of Motown, Marvin Gaye, Barry White. Like we just had like so much music in the house, like all the time. We would go to Congolese parties, like weddings. So I really grew up with music. I just feel like I had so much energy that my parents were like, okay, you're going to dance or you're going to do something to exude that energy. And so that was my first passion. But I always loved music, even growing up, like, I don't know, I was just a big fan of like French house. Like I love Daft Punk, like Cassius, like Bob Sinclair. Like I just, when people ask me like, what do you like as genre and music, it's hard even for me to pick because I grew up with a lot of different genres. And then as I made my own identity as someone who loves music, then I also have like this other universe that I love. So yeah, it's just, I'm a big fan of music. I love it.
What's your favorite type of music to play as a DJ?
Definitely Afro house, Afro tech. It's definitely where I feel the more confident and I feel the more in zone, in a flow of music. Yeah.
So when in this story do you start dancing? Do they put you in dance classes or something like that?
Yeah, so I used to do gymnastics when I was in France, and then when we moved to Canada, it was kind of a bit tough, and so I couldn't do gymnastics anymore, and so they decided to put me in at school. We had like dance classes, so then that's how I started. I started doing dancing in class there.
It was tough to be able to get you into gymnastics.
Yeah, just financials, yeah, and all that. Yeah. I have other siblings. We just immigrants and try to survive.
Right. It must be meaningful to be able to look at them and go like, hey, I'm a professional dancer. And now, hey, I'm an award nominated.
Yeah, it's very nice. I'm very proud. I hope they are. I know they are. But yeah, it's very nice.
What do they think of it? What do they make of it?
About the music, the dance?
Yeah, the whole thing. I mean, the whole journey you've been on.
I mean, I think that I always keep a great memory when they came and saw me at the Bell Center when we did the revival tour with Selena. I think that was my ultimate dream, for me to show to my parents, like, I made it. I'm at the Bell Center. Like that's where we saw all the shows growing up. Like, and so my mom and dad were there and I felt it. I looked at them in the eyes and they were like, yep, this is it. And I was like, yes. And then music, I think it's still something that's new. When actually I started doing the DJing, my mom was just questioning it. Sorry. She was like, why leaving something that you're so good at and you're doing it for something that you don't know anything about? And I was like, because that's just how I am. Like, I just love a good challenge. And so it took them a while. My dad was on board from the jump. But I feel like now, definitely with the nomination, I feel like they're both very proud. Yeah.
It's beautiful to see. I think it's really courageous that you did what you did.
Thank you.
And I think I'm just so happy to hear this story. So we're going to play Mad Mess before we go. Take me back into the studio on the day you made the song. What was happening?
Wow. Okay. So I was actually really mad, angry at a situation. I can't remember what it was. Something probably related to the pandemic, because I remember doing this in 2020. And I hadn't done a song where I was being angry. Like I always thought like, oh, I make music and being happy. And and so I was like, okay, I'm angry. Why not putting in a song? And then so that's how Mad Mess came about. And I remember sending it to my mentor, Stephen Ramsey, who's part of Young Galaxy. And I was just like, hey, what do you think about it? And he was like, what was happening? And I was like, I was just mad. He was like, yeah, you need to be angry, mad, whatever you're going through, you need to do that more often, because this is it. And I was like, Okay, thank you. And so that's how it came about.
It's a testament to showing your emotions no matter what they are. Thanks so much for making the time for us today. Congratulations. It's a really amazing story,
thank
man.
You.
To get to that level and then to have the courage to try something else and for this to be happening. It's a really remarkable story. Congratulations on
thank
it.
Thank you so much. And I mean, like, you know, to just finish on it, like, it's also the people that are around me. Like, I have amazing family, amazing, you know, partner and my team too. So it's great. I'm super proud, but I also want to give a shout out at least to the people that surround me, because I have people that really believed in me and pushed me to be on that journey. And so I think that's also, I'm not doing this on my own. I have a lot of amazing people around me. So yeah, thank you for having me also.
The Montreal DJ producer and dancer, Karaba, this is her Juno nominated song, Mad Mess. DJ Karaba, it's her song Mad Mess. It's up for Underground Dance Single of the Year, DJ Karaba's first Juno nomination. She's going to be at the awards March 24th in Halifax, Nova Scotia, as the Juno's official DJ. I'll be there. I'll be coming from Sobeys. For all your Juno's information, go to cbcmusic.ca. That's it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, I don't know if you've seen the movie Anatomy of a Fall. It's an interesting movie because the director, Justine Triet, says it's kind of okay to leave and disagree about the plot, disagree about what actually happened. Justine won the Oscar for the best original screenplay for it. She'll be here to tell you why she's not interested in stories that are easy or black and white. If you want to get in touch with me, q@cbc.ca is the best way to do that. Instagram, I'm at Tom Joe Power. The show is at CBCQ. Our podcast is also up and running and some really cool stuff up there right now. If you subscribe to our podcast, you'll see conversations with the likes of Michael Keaton and Billy Boyd and Dominic Monaghan and Maestro Fresh Wes and Bill T. Jones, which is one of my favorite conversations of the year. Go check that out. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.